It's Monday, December the 19th, 2011. This is the New Democratic Podcast. On today's show, a former radio broadcaster, small business owner, and educator, Thunder Bay Rainy Rivers MP, John Rafferty. A progressive politics aficionado from the United States originally, now he's the Member of Parliament for Thunder Bay Superior North, Bruce Heyer. Ontario's first NDP MP in over 10 years when he was first elected. Now, he's the House Leader for the NDP as official opposition, Joe Comartin. The New Democratic Podcast is not affiliated with the New Democratic Party of Canada. All opinions expressed therein are the properties of their respective owners. And this is the New Democratic Podcast. Hi there, I'm Kevin Tolan. I'm your host. We've got a lot of great interviews on today's show. Three members of Parliament. And in addition, we've got some live coverage from some of the events following the debates, the first NDP debates that occurred here in Ottawa. Let's get right into it with our first interview with John Rafferty.
All right, so you've been an MP since 2008. John, before you became an MP, you were a radio broadcaster and a small business owner. How did that background help you as you made the transition to being a member of Parliament?
Well, it's not just that background. It's also my background in education as a high school principal and teaching at a community college in Ontario. A wide and varied background. And I think that that's one of the things that make MPs or MPPs or anybody in any elected position makes them better if they better able to sort of deal with all the issues that come at them. Because, you know, the things you get in this job from constituents and from others has an unbelievable range. And so the more of a, maybe I could use the word generalist, the more of a generalist you are, I think the better off you are able to A, to understand what they're talking about, and B, to empathize with people. And I think that that's a critical quality that you need.
As someone that was formerly in the radio industry, what needs to change in terms of broadcasting policy in this country? Do you think that Canadian content laws are fair as they are right now? And is there anything else we could do differently to ensure arts, entertainment, and information access is more fair?
Well, you know what, the whole Canadian content controversy way back when it started, I don't know how many decades ago it is now, when it first started, was a huge discussion item. As it turned out, it was very good for Canadian artists, it was very good for Canadian talent, and for Canadian creativity and entrepreneurship. And so I don't see a problem with that. I think Canadian content in Canada is a good idea, certainly on radio. I'd like to see more of it in television, but it certainly is something that has done our country well and done our artists well.
You voted to scrap the gun registry. What led you to come to that decision, and how will scrapping the gun registry, in your opinion, help Canadian safety?
Well, you know, that's a good question. One of the things that I've always contended, and keep in mind that I first ran in 2000, mm-hmm. so this is a fairly long-standing issue in my riding and an issue that I've been aware of for a long time. What I did before the registry first came up for a vote in 2008 is I sent a survey out to all of our households, and I said, you know, this is going to be coming up. The long gun registry, how do you want me to vote? It was a pretty simple, straightforward sort of question. I sent it out in a 10%er, which means each of them had a little mail back, you know, postage free that they can send back. And I'll give you a little background to 10%ers. Generally, on any sort of 10%er that we send out, we get maybe 35 responses. In my riding, it goes out to about 28,000 households. So that's quite a few mailings. So we get about 35 back. So if we're talking about, I was going to say forestry issues, no, but we get a pretty good response from that. But, you know, some other issues, generally about 35. With this one, this survey, before the issue came up in Parliament, in the 40th Parliament, It was interesting that that I got almost 900 responses. So that told me that this is an important issue. Because keep in mind that of those 28,000 households, so there's a percentage of them, maybe even half or something, who don't even look at them. Right, you know, they just put them in with recycling or whatever the case may be. So 900 is a pretty good response, and 900 out of 28,000 households. I suppose if you extrapolate that to the sort of surveys that you see survey companies do when they do 1,001 Canadians across Canada, I'd say that's a pretty good response, a pretty good indication. 97% of those said if you have an opportunity to vote to scrap the long gun registry, please do it. That was, it wasn't 50%, it wasn't 70%, it wasn't 80%, it was 97%. You know, if it had been closer to 50-50, or if it had been, you know, anywhere else, it would have been a bit of a tougher decision. So then we had the votes, and as you know, I voted to scrap the long gun registry. It didn't pass, but I thought after that, okay, now there's more awareness right across Canada, but certainly, hopefully, more awareness of the issue in my riding, although 900 responses, I couldn't imagine there would be, you know, any more sort of understanding about the issue than there was before. So I said, well, you know what, I'll send the survey out again. You know, it's been in the news. People have perhaps taken sides where they weren't interested in the issue before, whatever the case may be. It came back, not as many. I think there were about 600 or so came back. And it was interesting, 87% of those said, if you have an opportunity to do it again, yeah, vote to get rid of the long gun registry. So I think that's a pretty good indication, aside from anecdotal things over the last decade, discussions with people, all candidates' meetings, and we don't have time here to go into some of those sorts of discussions I've had with people over the time. But it was eye-opening for me to still have a fairly large percentage, a good return, and a fairly large percentage of people say that. And so, you know, if you look at it and you say, well, you know, everybody had the same opportunity to send something back, you know, whether you're for or against it. And all things being equal, it's still a pretty good indication of how people want me to vote. And it's interesting that unlike some issues that are contentious, there's probably half a dozen issues that are contentious and get Canadians fired up. The right to die, for example, capital punishment, abortion, same-sex marriage. Those are the sorts of, and long gun registry. The sorts of issues where people get really fired up on.
Politics of division?
Well, it certainly is the way the Conservatives do business, yeah. It certainly is, and, you know, whether it was any of those other issues, it would be the same sort of thing that they would do that with all those issues. Now, on those other issues, I have very firm beliefs. The irony in this situation is that quite frankly, I don't hunt. I don't own any guns. I don't, you know. But I do believe first and foremost that, you know, I worked on my first NDP campaign more than 40 years ago, and I learned in that campaign. It was a provincial campaign. I learned in that campaign that your first responsibility when you are an elected official, whether it's federal or provincial or municipal, your first responsibility is to the people who elected you. There are people here in Ottawa who think differently, that the party comes first, for example. I don't subscribe to that. I believe that if you have a very clear indication of where the people in your riding want you to go on an issue, that you do that and you give them a voice, because that's your most important job. I believe that's your most important job, is to give people a voice. And, you know, I I've always said, and I'll talk about a survey in a second that I just read this morning. I've always said that if you give people a voice, they will get involved in politics. They will be interested in politics, because I've always said that one of the reasons people don't get engaged and aren't engaged is because they don't feel they have a voice. They feel they're powerless, that someone is not there speaking for them. And here, I'll get this. This is a very interesting... we're still here. Actually, from my radio days, that'll be interesting. It's sort of, you know, some ambiance here to the, if you just don't cut any of that out. Here's the title of the survey. Non-voting Canadians consider themselves outsiders. It's a research organization, Samara, S-A-M-A-R-A, if people want to look it up. And they found, contrary to what people think, the 40% of Canadians or so who don't vote, they are not apathetic, they are not uninterested, and they are not ignorant of our political system. Because that's the general feeling, right? You got 40% of people don't vote, they don't stay informed, they don't... This survey says otherwise. And it was quite an extensive survey, that they are interested. And it was drawn from all kinds of demographic groups, new Canadians, Francophones, youth, suburbanites, and all sorts of different people. And the results were consistent, which was very interesting. First of all, people who are not engaged called themselves outsiders, or some word that was sort of like that. And they didn't always feel powerless, but they had a concern that no one was responsive to their needs. And that's an interesting one, because right now you see what's happening with the Harper government in terms of, you know, sort of cutbacks. Service Canada, of course, is in the news right now that frontline staff is being cut. If you want people to not be engaged in the political process, that's what you do, because government is not responsive to those people. They respond to the way that they're treated. But it is interesting that they do feel that they don't have a voice, this generally speaking, this 40%. And not only that, many who do vote feel they don't have a voice. And so what I learned more than 40 years ago is just as relevant today as it was back then, that you have to give your constituents a voice. That's your first responsibility. And I'll give you a good example. For example, if I got 97% return on a survey I sent out to my constituents on same-sex marriage, and I didn't agree with that, I would still vote their way, because that's a clear indication to me that that's how people in my constituency feel. And I think that that's important, not just to engage people, and particularly young people, but to make sure that those voices are heard. You know, some parts of the country where the long gun registry is a big issue, for example, in the Prairie provinces, in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, for example. You know, it's interesting that in the last election, I think my numbers are right, you know, the NDP got 34% of the popular vote. We didn't get one seat. Now, part of that is how the seats are set up, but another part of it is there wasn't, something to take us over the top, and perhaps the long gun registry, which was big in the last election, was a part of alienating those voters out there. And so I think what leadership generally needs to understand, I'm not just talking about the NDP here, I'm talking about all political parties at all levels. I think what they need to remember is that every issue is not black and white. Every issue has all this gray area, and that's where the political expertise comes in to make sure that everybody has their voice, everybody is heard, and that you come up with answers and policies that reflect that. Sorry, I probably took up your whole 15 minutes here.
Oh, but, no, that's.
But you know, it's an important issue, it's like all those I call them the half dozen contentious issues that we'll face. You know, I tabled a bill a couple of weeks ago to ensure when companies go bankrupt that workers get their severance. So in other words, changing the Bankruptcy Act to ensure that workers come first. I don't need to do a survey in my riding to tell me that's something important to put forward for people in my riding. So it's not that I consult all the time, although I try to, you know, get all my mailings out and respond to people and talk to people all the time about issues. I think that's one of our jobs is to is to uh, is to not only keep our constituents informed, but to ask their opinions. And I think that's important. I don't think a lot of MPs do that.
I think you're probably right about that. You were instrumental in fighting the HST. You were there from the beginning, sounding the alarm. What's next? What can be done at this point to fight the HST, since it's already been implemented now in Ontario? It's been implemented for a while in other provinces. What's next in the fight against that?
Well, I think Andrew Horvath is on that. In fact, I think the Conservatives provincially are on site also, and they'll be continuing to pressure McGuinty on that. So I think HST is still in the works. In terms of removing HST off everything, the big problem I had with HST, and maybe this goes back to my answer to the last question, is that people were not consulted. Nobody was consulted on this. And this was a huge increase in taxation in the province of Ontario. But consultation aside, even if people in Ontario had been consulted, there was a way to implement it. You know, so for example, if you begin, you know, you want to combine the provincial and federal tax under one tax, supposedly to make things better for business, accounting easier, cheaper for wholesalers and suppliers and all sorts of things. I don't discount some of the benefits that there might be with HST. But why not? Why wouldn't the government do this? Now I don't want to put myself into Mr. McGuinty's shoes, but so there are a number of things in Ontario prior to HST that had both taxes on them. So let's begin there. Let's begin combining the tax on items where there already are two taxes. The other ones will stay the same. And over the course of time with this government and subsequent governments, as things change and taxation changes, you come and go with HST on things. You know, then you can deal with the economic realities at that particular time. And the big problem with the economic reality with HST in Ontario, particularly Northern Ontario, is that things that we need to survive suddenly had an 8% increase. Some had a 13% increase, didn't have taxes on them before. I'm talking about electricity. I'm talking about heating. I'm talking about transportation. I'm talking about, gasoline. And in Northern Ontario, for example, putting a third tax on gasoline, which is the HST, where in Northern Ontario we don't have a choice. We don't have public transit. You know, there's you can take in my riding, you've got a choice of taking a once daily bus, which is quite expensive, to Thunder Bay, so 200 Ks we're talking about, or you can take a taxi. It's $160. That's it. You can't jump on a Red Rocket. You know, you can't jump on OC Transpo and get to doctor's appointments and do all those sorts of things that you need to do. So there needs to be some consideration that all of Ontario is not the same either. And I guess maybe that goes back to the gray areas I was talking about. Understand that we are not all the same. At one time there was in Northern Ontario, we didn't cost us anything to register our vehicles. That was some decades ago. But the reason that was there, at least my understanding is, the reason it was there was to partly offset the extra cost that we had with gasoline and so on. That has since gone. It's still half, I think, of what you would pay in Toronto to register your car. So the remnants are still there. But, I have a trouble with a tax that comes in, no one is consulted, and essentials that you need to survive are suddenly enormously more expensive. And electricity is a very good example, because we're going to see in the next 2 years a doubling of hydro rates in Ontario. And that means a doubling of HST, of course. A lot of people are going to have some trouble. A lot of people are having trouble now.
So you'd say the focus is not just helping all your constituents, but especially making sure that the least of us are taken care of as well, people that have the least means?
Well, you know what, it's maybe a little cliche, but, you know, we're ultimately judged by how the weakest members of our society are treated. And weakest, poorest, put any kind of word you can sort of plug in there. But it's true. You know, and I'm not a religious man particularly, but, we are our brother's keeper. And we have to make sure that that nobody falls through the cracks. And that everyone has, particularly children, have the same opportunities as everybody else.
Thank you, John. I think we'll leave it at that.
There, of course, was a second NDP MP that voted to scrap the gun registry. That MP was from the neighboring riding of John Rafferty, Bruce Heyer. And he, of course, is the Member of Parliament for Thunder Bay Superior North.
All right, and I'm here today with Bruce Heyer, MP for Thunder Bay Superior North. Bruce, you were born over in the States. How did you end up over here in Canada?
Well, it's pretty simple. I'm an American by accident and a Canadian by choice. I moved to Canada for three reasons. One is wilderness. I love wilderness. Float plane pilot, canoeist. I lived in a teepee in a log cabin for 2 years, lived totally off the land. It was a riot, especially if you're young. The other two reasons that I moved to Canada were called Tommy Douglas and Pierre Elliott Trudeau. When I was in university, I was quite impressed with both of them, and at that time I thought I was half a Liberal and half an NDP, and so I moved to Canada so I could really pursue that. Of course, as we know now, the Liberals are no longer the party of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, so I'm 110% NDP now.
Bill C-311 from 2009, the Climate Change Accountability Act. Tell us a little bit about your part in it, and tell us about what happened to it, and tell us what it would mean to Canada to have it pass and actually receive royal assent.
In the last parliament, at the beginning of it, Jack Layton asked if I would reintroduce his climate change bill, the Climate Change Accountability Act. We tinkered with it and brought it up to date, and then I spent a year and a half persuading Liberals to vote for it. And at the end of the day, enough Liberals voted for it, actually showed up for the vote, and so it passed in the House, and that was very gratifying. That was a wonderful day. That was May 5th, 2009. Mm-hmm. So then it moved on to the unelected, unaccountable Senate, and it was stalled there for about 6 months. And then finally one day, on Harper's orders, the Senate killed Bill C-311, the Climate Change Accountability Act, in an hour. And I have the dubious distinction of being the author of the first bill in Canadian history to be passed in the House, killed in the Senate, with no consideration, no committee work, just totally political. A dubious honor.
The official line for the NDP is that the NDP wants to get rid of the Senate. Do you agree with that?
We either need to get rid of it, or my idea for the week is if we're going to elect it, let's elect it with proportional representation. As we all know, at least one of our two houses needs to be elected by proportional representation. So given that we haven't been able to do it in the House yet, maybe we can do it in the Senate.
Fair enough. Bill C-560, the Cell Phone Freedom Act. I see you've got some paperwork right there about it. This act makes it so that cell phone charges would be standardized, chargers would be standardized, which would theoretically cut down on e-waste. Isn't there a possibility that it would...
No, actually, that's not Bill 560.
That's not 560?
No,
okay.
560 is far more encompassing than that.
Okay.
This was introduced in the last parliament. We're going to reintroduce it for sure. And it goes way beyond just chargers. This is about unlocking cell phones so that at the end of your contract, or if you don't have a contract, you're not locked in with one service provider, one wireless service provider. We have three service providers that provide, I think it's 96% of all the service in Canada. We have the highest rates in the world, the lowest levels of competition. And so this bill would have forced those companies to unlock cell phones upon request with no charge. Two out of the three, based on the pressure from this bill, have actually gone ahead and done that voluntarily, but they're still charging $50 to do it, so we're going to stay on it.
To play devil's advocate here, or in this case, Tory's advocate, I guess, they might say, well, look, there's wind, right? So there's competition. What do you say to that?
I don't have a good answer.
Don't have a good answer? Okay. Wind Mobile, of course, is
the smaller
this company.
This is Andy's baby. Andy's my legislative assistant, and much of the legislation comes out of my ethics and backgrounds and passion. But Andy, this was really his baby, so I was the mouth and the face on the Cell Phone Freedom Act.
For folks that don't know, because some people might not be that into politics that they know much about in L.A., how much does the legislative assistant help you in the day-to-day?
In my constituency back home in Thunder Bay, Superior North, quite often I say, and I mean it, I work for you. But here on the Hill, I work for Andy Blair, my legislative assistant. It's that simple. And I 98% of the time do what Andy Blair tells me to do.
Now, there is another bill. I apologize I got the numbers wrong there, but there is a bill that is about cell phone charger standardization. Was that your bill?
It is Glenn Tebow's bill, Sudbury, and I was the seconder for it. It's a great idea. It would be ecological and convenient and save us all a lot of money and lots of good reasons for it.
What about companies such as Apple that make special charger connectors that also carry data with these smarter devices? Do you think it's the best idea to force? Might there be a possibility that there will be no more iPhones in Canada, for example, if that were to pass?
I would hate to speculate on where technology is going to go these days in the cell phone high tech market. I'm a low tech guy. I'm an old guy.
What are some issues that are particular to your riding that you're trying to address in the House?
Well, I feel that I represent several constituents. At one level, I represent the entire planet and ecosystems on the planet. I think that Canada has a history of making the world a fairer and safer and cleaner and more ecological place. We've fallen down on that lately, but I'm really interested in parks, protected areas, sustainability. I'm a biologist and a forester, had the climate change bill. So that's one constituency, the entire planet and all the living things on it. Another big loyalty is Canada itself. Having come to Canada by choice, I'm particularly focused on making this experiment work well. Canada is a great experiment, not quite yet perfected, but I think we can get there. And so I want to make sure that we continue to improve Canada. I work for my constituents in Thunder Bay. I love working for my constituents in Thunder Bay. And my least popular place to be is on the Hill. I call Ottawa 47 square miles surrounded by reality.
It's a good way to put it. Neighbor in the neighboring riding and neighboring office, John Rafferty there, I spotted him at a Thomas Mulcair event, and I suspect that might be where his loyalties lie, although I didn't have the chance to ask him about that in our interview yesterday. But as for you, do you have anybody in particular you're supporting in the leadership race?
I do. I support any one of our elected members of parliament who meet two criteria. One is bilingual and the other one is elected. Elected at least to a city council or a member of a provincial legislative assembly or the House of Commons. As a former scientist, I know that any one event like getting elected once could be a fluke. Getting elected twice is unlikely to be a fluke. So I'm only interested in candidates who've actually run for office, who've knocked on doors, who understand meeting and greeting people and pressing the flesh and dealing with public controversies, and who've been elected not once but twice.
And so beyond that, you don't have a particular preference?
I have a couple of favorites that I'm leaning toward, but I'm going to look at them until I've really heard from all of them in a number of debates and a number of fora to see who really has the royal jelly.
In our last podcast, I spoke with Mark LeFerrier, who was the candidate for MP from the Most Improved Riding Association, and he said he wants to start the hashtag on Twitter, No Bad Choices, because we have such a great stable of people here in the NDP. It sounds like you feel pretty similarly.
I think that most of our candidates for leadership meet my criteria and would make great future prime ministers.
I think we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, Bruce Heyer. Really appreciate your time.
That wasn't too painful. Thank you.
In the last several weeks, I've had the opportunity to attend several leadership events that have been held in Ottawa. Two of them were actually parties that were held after the Ottawa leadership debate, which was, of course, the first of the leadership debates. And so the first event I went to was Thomas Mulcair's event. This was recorded right after the leadership debates here in Ottawa.
All right, so we're at Brixton's Pub after the first leadership debate in Ottawa. I've got a couple of gentlemen here that are having some beers, which seems to go well with politics these days, you know, especially with the state of things. And they say they're unaffiliated NDP members. So, gentlemen, what are your names, first of all?
Paul. Mike.
All right, and, okay, first of all, Paul, have you made up your mind after this debate as to who it is that you're supporting?
No, I'm still undecided. I'm the way I look at it, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So I'm ready to see out the campaign and see how it goes.
Mike,
I had a good idea who I might support before the debate, but now that I've seen all of the candidates performing, I have a slightly different opinion, and I've narrowed the field, but I haven't actually made a final decision as to who I might support.
And what are you looking for in a candidate to lead the NDP?
Well, I'm looking for, obviously, for somebody who has good experience, who is able to well articulate the issues that are important to me, and who is able to focus on bringing a national profile to a party that seems to be still quite regionalized.
How do you think the one-member, one-vote scenario is going to play out?
I haven't actually looked into too many details in terms of the actual voting process, but I presume when they set up the structure, they'll try and do so in a democratic way that it represents the full wishes of the parties. So,
do you think that the online voting is going to help the turnout?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not everybody can go to Toronto as a delegate, particularly regionally. I mean, sending people from BC and, you know, other places, we want their votes to be counted too. So I think you kind of have to do that nowadays.
Do you think that online voting is a secure way to go as well? Do you think there's any potential for voter fraud or anything like that?
I would hope not. I mean, I presume when they set it up, they'll do it in a manner that looks into the security issues and does it in a secure way. I mean, like anything, it's vulnerable, but I don't think that's a reason to shy away from it, because the alternative to that is just sort of alienating a lot of other voices from other parts of the country.
Are there any top issues that you have in particular?
Well, the top issues are the same as a lot of people across the country, which is education, healthcare, and the environment. And the common thread between all of those issues is the economy. And there was a lot of talk today about the green economy and how we're going to move forward with in a period of economic uncertainty. And a lot of us, especially here in Ottawa, who are young professionals who are concerned about buying homes and things like this, are very concerned about how we can make ethical choices, about how to spend our money, how to invest our money, and how to get good returns, how to get good jobs. All of these questions that affect us and affect people who are underclassed as well.
Right on. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and now I'm over at Brian Topp's after Ottawa debate event at Avant Garde Bar, and just going around basically talking to people, seeing what they thought about the debate. So first of all, what's your name?
My name is Jason C. McLean.
And Jason C. McLean.
Yes.
You say you have a website?
Yes, I'm the editor-in-chief of forgettheBox.net. We're an arts and culture news, current events, blog/zine. Update a couple of times a day. We're Montreal-based, but we have writers all over. Yeah, and we're focused more on a lot of stuff is very opinionated, and we're very progressive-minded, and we're fiercely independent.
Excellent. And you're an NDP member, I take it?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and you've made up your mind on who you're supporting in the leadership race?
Yes, and as evidenced by where I am right now, I'm definitely supporting Brian Topp. I think that Brian will succeed, replace Stephen Harper as Prime Minister while keeping us to our NDP roots. and not change us into the Liberals just to beat them.
And did the debate have any influence on that, or did you already had your mind made up a while back?
The debate definitely reinforced what I was thinking and helped to solidify what my thoughts were. Brian basically said, we don't want to become the Liberals to beat them. He didn't say it in those words, but he said something very similar to that. And well, a lot of the other candidates did seem very very interesting. I think a lot of them would make great cabinet ministers, but I prefer Brian as prime minister because I think he's gonna succeed. And politics are shifting to the left. The center is moving to the left now. What was like the fact that like someone like Harper was possible, I don't think that would be the case in 4 years. Look at like Occupy. Look at stuff like that. Look at the way that the mentality is shifting away from this corporatist mentality. The candidate that's speaking out against corporations is now going to be the mainstream candidate in 4 years.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, too.
All right, we're at Romeo Saganash campaign event here, and I've got...
Richard Fidler.
Richard Fidler with me. And Richard, what brought you to the event tonight to hear Romeo?
Well, I was interested, of course, in the NDP leadership campaign, and I was looking to find some candidate who would, or candidates who would, you know, stimulate discussion of major political issues that face us today and so on. And I thought that it was very good that you had, I think for the first time in Canadian history, an Indigenous leader recognized as such who was contesting the leadership of a federal political party. And I wasn't well acquainted with the ideas of Romeo Saganash, although I was aware of his name and so on. One of the things I did actually a few weeks ago was to Google his name and find what he had written in the past or what was available in terms of statements and so on various questions. And I, among other things, I came across a very interesting article that he had written a long time ago, before the last Quebec referendum, after the defeat of the Meech Lake Accord, on the question of Aboriginal governance and ethnic nationalism. It's in a scholarly journal in Quebec. It's written in French, but I'm a translator by profession, French-English. So I was very interested in it, and I thought he had some very good ideas in it on the relationship between Indigenous self-determination and Quebecois self-determination, and how they could be integrated and perhaps not necessarily resolved, but at least negotiated in a mutual process that would respect each other's autonomy and right to self-determination. And I actually wrote to Romeo and asked if he didn't mind if I, first of all, if those were still his views, because I found them quite interesting. I hope that he would present them in the campaign, among other things that he has to address. And that I thought I might even translate parts of this article. It's a very long article, and put them on my blog, which I have, and I do that to his attention. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that Romeo saw the letter, because he never replied, but his campaign manager tells me that he saw it and that they are favorable to this. So I will shortly be writing about it in my blog, which is called, and you can Google this, Life on the Left.
Life on the Left.
On the Left, okay. That's right. And I address various questions, but the main concentration is on Canadian politics, and especially the Quebec national question and Indigenous issues and so on.
And if people want to find your blog, they just go to Life on the Left?
Life on the Left. That's
okay,
right.
Is it Life on the Left, like .blogspot.com? Or?
It's a Blogspot. You got
Blogspot
it.
Blogspot one. Okay, so it's one of the Blogspot ones. Excellent.
Very good. So anyway, but I also wanted to meet with Romeo and hear what he had to say about other issues as well. So that's why I'm here tonight.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with me. You have a button, and so you're all set to go.
I'm all set to go. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. And what's your name?
Donna Silver.
And Donna, why are you here at Romeo's event tonight?
Because I've looked at what's on the buffet, I suppose, if you will, of candidates who are hoping to work with Canadians to get the kind of country that we need, including returning back to democracy. And I believe that Romeo has the most credentials that fit the boxes that I would tick off with regard to getting there. He's got all the experience with the United Nations, with negotiating all kinds of deals with the Hydro people, and I think it's the Hydro people. I could be wrong on that, so you might want to double check. But with he's been around, in other words, at the negotiating. He's got a lawyer's degree, so he knows his stuff. He knows his stuff with the native population, with the English, with the French, and he can bring all of those people together to try to form some sort of a solution to everybody's problems. Not that he's got the magic touch or anything like that in the larger sense, but like I said, I've looked at his credentials, and it's my understanding that based on the other folks who all have stuff to offer as well, most of them are sort of on a, I want to do this, and it's a one-track trajectory, and he's more broader-based, and the more broader-based you are, the more appeal you have to more people who want the things you're offering.
So you'd say he definitely already had your vote when you walked in the door here today?
Yes, but I didn't before the debate.
Okay, really? So it was the debates that turned you around?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Okay.
A previous NDP leadership hopeful, Joko Martin was the first NDP MP from Ontario in 10 years, and he's really built a lot of momentum. He's had quite a colorful history, of course, and has risen to do some very great things for the party. Now he's serving as the House Leader for the NDP as official opposition. Here's our exclusive interview with Joko Martin.
Joe, tell us a bit about your childhood and your experiences growing up and how they influenced your decision to become a part of the NDP.
Well, I was born into a family, ultimately, of 8 kids. My father died when I was less than a year old. My mother was expecting my younger brother, who was born about a month later. Quite poor the first 4 or 5 years. My mother was a teacher, but given the number of children she had to care for, she stayed at home. But we basically had some income from the farm that we were living on, but it was a very small farm. It wasn't enough to support a family, and so we were on, I guess at that time, the municipal welfare rolls. When my younger brother went to school, then my mother went back teaching full time, and it was an interesting community because we were going through a real change in that community at the time. The community had been, up until the Second World War, I was born in 47, so just after the war, had been 80-90% Francophone. My mother, unfortunately, did not speak French. She was English-Irish background. But we were going through a process as I got into really up to my teens, at 10, 12 years after I was born, of the community being significantly changed from being primarily Francophone to being roughly equal English and French communities. I went to a one-room, 8 grade school, both languages being taught by I had the same teacher from grade 1 to grade 8, no kindergarten. Spent a great deal of my time self-educated. Again, I was lucky because my mother was a teacher, so that was a big help in terms of our education. But, you know, I'd get 20 minutes a day of instructions from the teacher. And, you know, it's one of those things you talk about, you know, changes, just sort of fateful changes. But when I was in grade 4 or grade 5, the county library system began bringing library books to us. And it was, so I then had, you know, extensive material that I could read, which is how I spent my time. Because there was nothing else to do once I got those 20 minutes of instructions, did whatever I had to do in terms of the school. I had usually at least two hours a day where I could go. And my teacher was really good with me. I didn't have to ask permission. I could just go to what was an armoire, actually, clothing armoire full of books, and I could just take out books. That's how I spent my education. We moved off the farm into a small town into Bell River just outside of Windsor when I went to high school. That was a fairly significant change from, you know, having 40, 50 students in one school to, I think that at that point the school was probably 700. That first year was a bit of a difficulty, but I adapted fairly well to the school. Again, you know, my mother, I said, was a teacher, but by that point, two of my sisters were also teachers, so there was a good deal of instruction at home that I could rely on.
You won a seat in the 2000 election, and you were the first federal NDP candidate to win in Ontario in 10 years. What was it like in those early days when you were in office in a sea of Liberal red, and what were you able to do to help turn things around to help create the environment that we see today?
Well, I always tell the story about one of my brother-in-laws who I said, you know, I have this, this was before I was elected, I said to him, I have this sort of nightmare, and I did actually have a couple of nightmares, that I would wake up the day after the election in 2000, November 2000, and find out that I was the only member for the whole of the province. His response to me, and this was before the election, was, well, it's better to wake up being the only member elected as opposed to not having any NDP members elected. And he was right about that, but it was certainly a major challenge. You know, we had 103 seats at that point. There was myself, two Reform members who were elected for the first time that year, and all the rest were Liberals. A huge demand on me from the province, because we had gone at that point almost 10 years, 7, 8 years, I guess, without any NDP members in the province at the federal level. So, and I guess particularly in immigration matters, for whatever reason, a number of the Liberals in and around the Toronto area had stopped doing immigration files and just were refusing to do any. So I had a lot, that first couple of years, I just had a lot. I had to stop saying I could do any of them, and it was difficult. So that was one. I also did a lot of traveling that first couple of years. I remember being up north. I was the environment and natural resources critic, being up in the north into the forestry and steel mills up there, in Sault Ste. Marie and Sudbury, and then in the north on forestry, further north on the forestry issues. So there was this huge demand on my time as a result of that. That was as challenging as I think I've had. It eased off. It was kind of interesting. As soon as Brian Massey was elected, which was in 2002, about 18 months, 20 months after I was first elected, just having that second person took a great deal of pressure off, both in terms of local stuff in the riding where we had take turns going to events.
Because Brian Massey's in the neighborhood.
Yeah, Brian's the next riding over.
Yes.
So it was extremely helpful, but that was a challenging period. And then shortly after that, I opted to run for the leadership of the party. So I was then not only, you know, finding it difficult to handle the Ontario stuff, but I was getting more and more requests as I traveled across the country for assistance, primarily, I guess, in the immigration area.
Now, that was 2003 that you ran in the leadership race, of course. Why did you decide not to run this time around?
I would say it was a straight age factor. I'll be 64 in a couple of weeks. And after losing a leader, losing Jack to health problems, it was just way too much of a risk to, I guess, expose the party, because if my health deteriorated. I feel that if you're going to run to leadership, you're making a commitment up front for 8 to 10 years, assuming you win. And, that would put me into close to my mid-70s at that point. And similarly, if my wife suffered health problems, I would have to withdraw. There was just no way that the party could take that kind of risk.
You look healthy as a horse, so I'm sure you're going to be
Listen, Kevin, I'm quite clear. I'm a very humble person, but I'm quite clear. I work as hard as anybody does, and in fact, I tell my caucus colleagues that, with the exception of Nicole, and it was the same with Jack, with the exception of the leader, I work harder than anybody. And I can't say that I get a lot of support from my caucus in that regard, but yeah, no, I'm not having any problem at all. Doing my job and working. I do work a heavy schedule, there's no question of that. And as far as I can see, and my doctor, as my doctor says, I'm disgustingly healthy, that's what he says. And So I don't see any problem doing it, but of course, you know, as you age, there's always the risk levels go up dramatically, and there was just no way I was going to expose the party to that risk.
Well, if you were handling immigration files for GTA MPs when you were this lone NDP member from Windsor, I have no doubt that you work harder than anybody. You had a distinguished legal career prior to becoming a member of Parliament. You are also the Shadow Cabinet Minister for Justice. What is the biggest problem that you foresee with the Conservative Party's omnibus crime bill?
Well, I mean, the real serious risk of it beginning to put such a financial burden on the provinces, because they're carrying the bulk of the cost for these crime bills, and we're seeing it in the U.S., and I'm not fear-mongering here. This is a realistic danger that we're approaching. We're seeing states in the U.S. Having bankrupted themselves. Now, there they mostly did it to themselves because there they passed their own crime laws, but state by state. But here it's being dumped on the provinces. A good number of them, it's quite clear, especially in this last year or so, where this has become more, I guess, knowledgeable to them. They freely admit they do not have the ability to fully assess the cost, but the preliminary data that's coming out, some of which I've given them, would certainly suggest that long term, and I'm talking 5 to 10 years, they're simply not going to be able to afford this. And beginning to steal dollars from education, from health, social services, you know, infrastructure, all of those budgets, again, mirroring what happened in the U.S., all of those budgets start leeching money to the prisons. The other big risk here, the other big danger, is that based on the U.S. experience, it doesn't do anything to lower the crime rate. And in fact, over a period of time, because you end up turning out more hardened criminals who have spent longer time learning how to be criminals, your crime rate begins to go back up.
Congratulations on becoming House Leader of the NDP. What is different now in your daily routine in the House compared to when you were just working as an MP? And how does being House Leader give you more of an opportunity to make a difference in the lives of ordinary Canadians?
Well, I guess on my personal schedule, I'm finding myself just being in constant meetings with the other parties, their leadership, but also with my caucus members and, I guess, the executive of our caucus, senior people in our caucus. But I seem to be in constant meetings. I still sit on one committee, but I also sit on the Board of Internal Economy that's responsible really for the financial and overall administration of the House of Commons, the whole Hill. And so there's just constant meetings. I find I have less time that I control myself, that I'm constantly having to go to these meetings. So that's probably the biggest change that I'm seeing. I don't think I'm working any more hours, but they're different types of time that I'm spending. In terms of the influence that you have as House Leader, in a majority government, it's certainly less of an impact than it would be in a minority government. But on the other hand, there's, quite clearly, and I think part of this is my own personal reputation, I think I'm recognized as knowing the rules of the House, probably maybe better now than anybody in the House. We have staff people who know it better than we do, I'll hasten to add, in all three parties, major parties. But I'm recognized that, so oftentimes I find when I'm actually speaking in the House on procedural points, they pay more attention to me. And I think in particular, I had one last week where I got up on the wheat board bill and the decision by the federal court to slap the minister down for doing what was, in effect, an illegal act with regards to that bill. And I remember a bit surprised, actually, the staff people at the table, I mean, these are the real knowledgeable ones, them turning and paying attention to what I was saying. They don't oftentimes do that. So I have that kind of influence just at a personal level. As the House Leader of the official opposition, we have some significant impact on the scheduling of events, how we treat the legislation that's going through the House, who we choose to speak on the bills. That all has an influence. It more often is more long-term. So we'll pick a person, for instance, who gives just a really quite eloquent speech. that sticks in people's minds. The media pick up on it. So there's a longer-term influence. But on a day-to-day basis, we do have some impact on the schedule. I mean, we're fighting with the government right now with the time allocation. And our goal really is to just wear them down. There's ways of I guess, paying them back for using time allocation. It's so undemocratic that we have to respond, and we're constantly looking at mechanisms to do that, both in the House and in committee. And we'll see, you'll see more of that if they continue with this agenda.
Joe Comartin, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
And that concludes the second edition of the New Democratic Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Tolan. We've got lots of surprises for you in the upcoming episodes. More members of Parliament, including some NDP leadership candidates, will be joining us for more exclusive interviews. Please support us by following us on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is @TotallyTolan. Definitely tell all your friends about the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and any other way you can. If you are interested in volunteering to help the New Democratic Podcast, please definitely get a hold of us. My email address is ktolen@gmail.com. That's ktolen@gmail.com. Likewise, if you work for a member of parliament or a member of some other legislative assembly, such as a provincial level assembly, definitely get in touch with us. Again, ktolen@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the New Democratic Podcast. I look forward to lots of great episodes coming up as the leadership race continues. We're going to get a lot more in-depth into the leadership race as time goes on. And then we're going to start having roundtables, including on topics such as Senate reform, the environment, and the Conservative government's use of things such as cloture to stifle dissent in the House. Remember that this podcast can be downloaded via the iTunes Store free of charge or through the BlackBerry Podcast Directory. Thanks again for listening. Don't let them tell you it can't be done.